From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we'll unpack the promises made and broken by Foxconn in Wisconsin and the $400 million burden it's already created for the state. Then we hear how Running Rebels has been improving the lives of Milwaukee youth for 40 years.
But when you say, who want to be a part of basketball? Who want to get in the music studio? Who want it is? There's some requirements. You got to get your grades. Now you get the young people, and now you are allowed to help them make better decisions.
Plus, our series on entrepreneurship, How Did You Do That?, explores how Lori Cross drove innovation inside of big corporations to change medical technology.
They helped me really develop what became sort of my philosophy that, you know, you got to find something, a problem that's really worth solving that gets you excited about a solution.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. When Foxconn first announced its plan to open a huge LCD factory near Racine, the project promised to be one of the biggest deals in Wisconsin history. Foxconn and Wisconsin's Republican leadership claimed it would create 13,000 jobs and generate billions in revenue. And that was key, since the deal also meant that Foxconn would be getting $3 billion in subsidies, making it the largest government handout to a foreign company in U.S. history. But it's 2 years later, and little has materialized. Despite claims by Foxconn, the company hasn't built an LCD factory, and what they have created is a building 1/20th the size of the initial plan. A state report recently revealed by The Verge shows there is no LCD factory, and it seems very unlikely there will ever be one on the site where eminent domain forced residents to leave their homes. The few jobs that were created are far less than the thousands promised by this time, and many of those employed aren't entirely sure what they were hired to do. Josh Jezza is an investigations editor and the feature writer who has been reporting on Foxconn for The Verge. He says that his conservative estimate found the state has already spent $400 million on this deal. Jezza joins me to talk more about what he found through his reporting. Josh, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
This is a loaded question, but it's really hard to have this conversation without starting here. Can you give us a kind of truncated timeline of what's happened with Foxconn here in Wisconsin?
So this all started in early 2017 when Foxconn's founder, Terry Goh, started floating the idea of a big factory in the U.S. somewhere. The Trump administration took him up on that, arranged a meeting with then Governor Scott Walker. And there was sort of a bidding war between several states. Walker really wanted it. And then by the end of 2017, sort of the summer of 2017, and then I believe it was November 2017, the contract was finally signed with WEDC to create this enormous LCD factory in exchange for what came to total about $4.5 to $4.8 billion subsidy. And then the summer of 2018, there was a groundbreaking ceremony with Trump and Walker and Goh and various other officials that was supposed to begin construction on this giant manufacturing complex.
Well, and for people who've been out that way, it does appear that there has been some movement. You can see that there's been some construction, but ever since this deal was first announced, there have been a lot of red flags. As you talk about in your piece, of course, Foxconn themselves started to kind of hedge what they were promising. They have the groundbreaking ceremony. Trump comes. They're calling it the eighth wonder of the world, as your article points out. What happens then?
So, yeah, there's always been a lot of haziness around exactly what Foxconn was building. And this even predates the contract. When Foxconn first was talking with the Walker administration about building something. They were proposing two different factories. One is called a Gen 10.5 giant LCD factory, makes big screen LCDs. The other one was a Gen 6, which was smaller. They went with the 10.5, but at some point it came to be the size of both factories combined almost. But then, as you said, shortly before the groundbreaking, a Foxconn executive said, actually, we can't make the 10.5 here, you know, largely because the suppliers aren't here. They would need an on-site glass maker. So they'll make the smaller one. Then beginning of 2019, the executive says again, actually, we're not going to build LCDs at all. It doesn't make sense. It's not commercially viable. Trump calls Foxconn immediately, announces we'll build LCDs, in fact, and then starts moving forward with what they say is a Gen 6 LCD facility. But as you said, they are building something. It's not that. It's not a Gen 6 by the conventional understanding of the term. But the company has been sort of flailing around trying to figure out what to do, building buildings that have no clear purpose for the last 2 years.
So there were a lot of promises that were made. And I think it might be best to just kind of go through them and see what's actually happened. So they promised, you know, tens of thousands of jobs, a huge infusion of money into the area. With the number of jobs, where are we at with that? You actually had a chance to talk to people who worked for Foxconn. It seems very interesting.
It is very interesting. So that's right. They promised 13,000 jobs. It was supposed to ramp up very quickly. So at the end of 2019, they were supposed to have a little over 2,000 jobs. In fact, WDC found that they had 281 that were eligible under the contract. But one of the real problems with pinning down exactly how many people work at Foxconn is that a lot of these people were hired very late in the year in part of an attempt to reach the threshold Foxconn needed in order to receive subsidies. Each year is supposed to employ an escalating number of people in order to get payments from the state. And Foxconn quite explicitly was trying to hit those numbers, which meant hiring people that did not have actual work to do in many cases. And then at the end of 2019, a lot of those people were local college students, foreign students on visas. Many of them didn't have real roles, and a lot of people were laid off starting in 2020. And so figuring out an exact number of how many people work there is difficult, but you know, we have these snapshots from the applications at the end of the year, about 280. There have been layoffs since then. Foxconn says it has about 500 people now. The real issue is it's not 13,000. It's not anywhere near where they're supposed to be at this point. And a lot of these jobs are pretty strange, not having a real role, sort of trying to figure out something to do because they believed in the project and want to make it real, but having all proposals stall or get vetoed by Foxconn management. And, you know, talk to people who spent a significant amount of time just watching Netflix or taking long lunches.
Well, and that was a big part of the promise. When this deal was initially announced, a big thing that they were touting, specifically Republicans inside of the state of Wisconsin, they were saying we were going to have all of these new blue-collar jobs. Here in Milwaukee, that means a lot. We've lost a lot of factory jobs, really starting in the 1970s, but accelerated over the last couple decades. What were the kinds of jobs that they actually created, at least the ones that you were able to verify?
That's a good question. Not really manufacturing jobs. They hired a lot of corporate services people early on, various other roles. You can kind of get a picture, actually. WDC did an audit at the end of 2019 of what people were doing. And you have some software engineers, you have people in sales, business development, that kind of thing. You have a few people who are working on circuit board manufacturing. Foxconn is doing, they're doing something with servers. It's quite small from what I've been able to tell. We're talking, you know, a few dozen people maybe. So the blue collar manufacturing jobs did not really appear. If Foxconn is on its way to finding something to do in Wisconsin, it's likely going to be a fairly automated, small scale assembly manufacturing line. not the 13,000, probably not even 1,000, but hard to say exactly.
Well, that's something that your article gets into, or one of your articles gets into, that for me was very astounding reading. I mean, there was the hedging initially about what kind of factory that they would have. But inside of your piece, you say they didn't even really have an idea for what they'd be doing in southeastern Wisconsin. As it stands right now, do we know what the plan is for southeastern Wisconsin, for the buildings that they've already created?
We do not. As far as I know, Foxconn has not said what, I mean, Foxconn has said that they're going to make LCDs in that factory, but, you know, at various points they were looking for other people to move into it. The building, they recently took out a permit to use the LCD manufacturing part of it as storage. It is not on its way to becoming an LCD factory. And in fact, state document that I got through a records request says it is not, by any conventional understanding, it is not a Gen 6 LCD facility. They have not ordered the equipment they would need to make LCDs. It would be the smallest such facility in the world. It says it's more like a display building. It is not a long-term commercially viable LCD factory. And so it's unclear what Foxconn will use it for. It's possible, you know, similar to what Foxconn already does in Mexico and other places, they'll send in components that are made in China to be assembled into TVs or monitors or whatever in that building. It would not have the supply chain impacts that were promised. It would not employ nearly as many people as were promised. But the short answer is no, we don't know what's happening in any of these buildings.
I think that gets to this larger point. Throughout this process, Foxconn seemingly hasn't just lacked transparency. It seems like they've been deliberately misleading at different points about what their plans really are. Is that a fair thing to say?
It's difficult to, I've never quite been able to figure out how much of this is Foxconn not knowing what Foxconn is doing and not wanting to admit it, and how much of it is coming from pressure to maintain appearances that they're doing what they promised. But for a year and a half, you know, I've gone through correspondence in which the state says, we'll revise the contract to reflect what you're doing, essentially, but you have to say what you're doing. And Foxconn sort of going back and forth and not really doing it, or doing it for a bit and then backtracking and consistently saying, we're building an LCD factory, even if it's clear that they're not on a trajectory to do that. Why Foxconn is doing that, I don't really know. Of course, they got yelled at by Trump when they said they weren't building an LCD factory. And if you look at Tarrigo's statement, which refers to Trump multiple times and working with him and going to Wisconsin being his idea, and there was a sense among employees as well that this project was always political and needs to be maintained for that reason, that appearance needs to be maintained for that reason. I certainly think it's fair to say Foxconn has not been transparent about what it's doing. The reasons why, I'm not really sure.
As you mentioned, there have been a lot of politics that are tied up in all of this. Racine, I believe, is now in Wisconsin's first congressional district, which at the time would have been Paul Ryan's district, now Brian Steele's. It's also Wisconsin itself, a swing state that is often divided to the point that many of our elections are decided by a very small amount of voters. So this was something that was really promoted by the people in power at the time, Governor Walker, a Republican, and our Republican-led legislature and assembly. So far, have we seen any evidence of Republicans inside of the state, outside of the state, taking accountability for what's happened here?
I have not seen that. Yeah, the state Republicans have been quite vocal proponents and defenders of the project. From what I can tell, that defense seems to have gotten quieter lately, but I wouldn't say I've seen anyone criticize the deal who used to support it. Still appears to be quite partisan. And lately you have the federal level, you have Navarro, you have Trump mentioning it, saying that it will bring great things, that it's on track.
Despite the fact that we can tell it's not.
Right.
As you look at this situation here in Wisconsin, through your reporting, what have you found as the major pitfalls in this deal? Was it the state not being on top of what they were asking of Foxconn? Was it, you know, Foxconn miscommunicating things? Where were some of the breaks in this deal?
From what I've seen, it doesn't seem like anyone involved in this deal at the outset seriously examined the likelihood Foxconn would do what it was promising. If you talk to industry experts, they'll tell you that a glut in the LCD industry was foreseeable at the time, that major suppliers would have to co-locate with Foxconn to make this giant factory a reality. There were real red flags at the beginning about the likelihood that Foxconn would build this thing, even leaving aside the fact that Foxconn routinely promises giant factories that don't show up. And so I think the state really entered into this deal, started building infrastructure, started relocating people in preparation for a factory that never seemed that likely to appear, and then continued doing that even after Foxconn started publicly wavering in its plans. I think that was the first major pitfall.
Yeah. Now, this is a difficult question to really answer and assess, but as it stands, how much money has Wisconsin lost in this deal?
Yeah, so the number I've come up with, which is a conservative estimate, is at least $400 million. I wouldn't say it's been lost, but it's been spent on, you know, developing roads for the thousands of workers that Foxconn was going to need, sewer, water, power infrastructure that this factory is supposed to need. Maybe some other company will use that, but it does not seem foreseeable that Foxconn will. Some of that money comes from the local governments, which technically will get repaid by Foxconn. You know, they were counting on property taxes from the TID district to pay off that debt. Foxconn is contractually obligated to make up the shortfall. Whether that happens, I don't know. But yeah, at least $400 million has been spent. There are other numbers. The Mount Pleasant was supposed to take out about $800 million in debt to take on this project. They haven't issued all those bonds, but it's a significant amount.
As you mentioned, there were safeguards in the initial deal that would put Foxconn on the hook for, you know, some of these expenses. Is there any way for us, the state of Wisconsin, the United States, is there any way of holding Foxconn accountable for the promises they made but couldn't keep?
I'm not really sure, other than denying them future subsidy payments, which the state has already done. I think anything else would be something for a lawsuit to resolve.
Well, Josh, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today. And thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Josh Jezza is an investigations editor and feature writer who covers technology, business, and climate change for The Verge. You can find links to his ongoing reporting on Foxconn in Wisconsin at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll hear from a group that's been working to improve the lives of Milwaukee kids for four decades. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. There are a lot of things vying for the attention of Milwaukee youth, and most will experience at least one adverse childhood experience that can make their adult lives more difficult. Having at least one adult provide a positive environment can help steer kids in the right direction. For the last four decades, Running Rebels has been doing just that for hundreds of Milwaukee youth. The organization works to prevent involvement in gangs, drugs, violence, and the juvenile justice system. Victor Barnett is the director and founder of Running Rebels, and Dawn Barnett is the co-executive director. Victor started Running Rebels with a group of about 50 kids in Milwaukee who decided they wanted to play basketball together. He and Dawn Barnett spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about what the organization has accomplished since they started 40 years ago.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your upcoming 40-year anniversary of Running Rebels being an organization working to help youth in Milwaukee. When you look back at all you've done, what are some of your biggest or proudest accomplishments?
For me, as the founder, some of the biggest accomplishments for me is when I see a young person that were a part of this organization when they were 12, 13 years old, and to now 10, 15 years later, to see the right choices that they've made in life, the decisions to be a productive, positive person to society, but then the bigger piece for them to have in their heart to give back and come back and do something to help somebody else. Those are the type of things that let me know and let us know that we've done it the right way and for the right reasons.
I'm most proud of the growth of the organization. I mean, going from, because Victor started it by himself, you know, 40 years ago. So to go from one person to over 100 people, and just the journey along the way, all of the ups and downs and the struggles, challenges, opportunities and joys, you know, just being able to see that through for 40 years, that in itself, I believe is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah. Victor, did you ever think when you started this, I would be sitting here talking about the 40th anniversary of this organization and so full of all these stories and successes from the people you've helped?
Often a lot of people don't believe me when I say it, but the answer is yes. When I first started, I had such a beautiful group of young men that were a part of my basketball team at the time. We sat down and we talked about who they wanted to be. When they said they wanted to be the Running Rebels, I just saw them involved in the decisions, everything from the name after the college basketball team, Running Rebels, to the colors that they wanted their uniforms to be. It always involved young people. So that next year, those 50 went and told their friends, and then I got 100 young people standing out there. I just felt that the brotherhood that was formed, that beautiful group of first group of young men, I just felt they were going to be successful. So Dale Williams being the first young man I ever worked with, and I was a part of the Air Force, and then he came back to coach for Running Rebels, and that whole giving back, I knew he was going to be a good young man. So many of those first beginning young men. And then after that, just can you imagine every year having 50 to 100 young people that benefit from the organization as far as being a better person. And now they get older and they in this same community. So I just kind of felt it would be only a matter of time before it spread it. And then now you got thousands of young people that were a part of this movement. And if we can align some of that with other people, it only could bring about good things.
Yeah, so tell me about some of these personalities that you all have met, people who have grown through your organization. What are some favorite memories of kids you've helped that you think of when you look back?
I think for me, the gamut is from A to Z. You know, we got young people that have never been in trouble. They just needed to be around the right environment. So we have a gentleman, Kevon Looney, been with us since maybe fourth grade, who's now in the NBA. First round draft choice, which is a dream come true for anybody that chooses basketball as their career. Got two NBA championships. I mean, how special is that? And what was so special about him is when I got phone calls from NBA teams to ask me about him, and they just wanted to know his character. And for me to tell them how good a young man he was, the story is told when he signed to go to UCLA, most people would say, I'm going to UCLA. I'm not going to tutor anymore and work with kids. He chose to continue tutoring kids, even though he was getting ready to go to UCLA college. So he was a special person that we knew having him around, he would be in the right place, but just him rubbing off on others and how important that was. And then from that, we could take somebody that was facing 20 years in jail. We got two young men that don't have no shame in saying their story, but they were facing years in jail and got assigned to their mentor and did everything right and became successful men. So one of them is an engineer to this day, graduating from Tuskegee. And another one, when we see how much he cares about his kids, oh, it's one of the most special feelings in the world. So those are totally opposite of each other. NBA champion to a person facing 20 years in jail that became successful. And that's where we just feel good about some of the stories and examples we have. Dawn, any more young people you could think of?
Yeah, I have a young lady who, you know, at the time, I didn't think I was even getting through to her. And oftentimes in the work, you know, in the work that we do, there are young people who, you know, you pour into, and you're just not getting anything back. And I thought, well, you know, I just don't think it's landing on her. And I ended up running into her 10 years later. And she said, Miss Dawn, I just want to thank you so much. Because everything that you taught me, it helped me later in life. And I was just, that one interaction taught me so much about patience. It taught me about not making assumptions. And just, it was encouraging me to say, you know what, regardless of what I'm getting back in that moment, because you just never know what a young person is going. You don't know how things percolate. Things percolate differently, you know, for every person. So I, you know, that's something I often share with our staff who can get frustrated when they're not getting that immediate satisfaction of I'm helping somebody. I know I'm helping somebody. Sometimes we don't know that we're helping somebody, but this taught me to keep going, to keep putting, you know, and planting those seeds. And because you never know. And sometimes you might hear about it years later and sometimes you might not, but just remaining positive to know that we're making a difference.
Yeah, I would imagine it's so rewarding not only to see the potential that someone has, but then to see it realized maybe in ways you expected, maybe in ways you didn't, but also the challenge of having no idea, Dawn, like you were saying, if it's getting through, if it's happening, that has to be really rewarding to find out later. But I would think that would be such a challenge not to really know where things might go.
Yes, absolutely. You don't know, you know, and like you said, sometimes you're surprised and sometimes you're heartbroken. We're in this field that you can't save everybody and we lose people along the way. So it is, you know, for me, it's trying to hold on, you know, to those stories, those people who, you know, who give me that hope and can refuel me in those times when we're not successful.
I think at the end of the day, I think it's so important to be able to say, did we do everything we can do for that young person? And if the answer is yes, then all you can do is your best and hope that it connects now. But as Dawn stated, sometimes down the line, and sometimes it don't. There's a young man that was incarcerated and 20 years of his life, he was spent in jail. But he told me himself, because we keep in touch, that I was worried, did I do everything I could do to help him? He said, you did everything. I was the one that made those choices. And to hear him even talking like that now, yes, it's too late because he's incarcerated, but it's sinking in often when we don't even know it.
Yeah, it sounds like you all are so connected to the long term and the past of this community. So thinking about the purpose of Running Rebels, how do you think you've accomplished what you set out to do?
Well, as a kid, I remember being in fourth grade, my saying was I was going to help change the world. Didn't know what that meant, but I was going to help change the world. So I think what we've done over these 40 years is poured into so many young people that have become successful adults and they are continuing that work. I think we definitely set out to do that, and we've accomplished that we are trying to help make the world a better place because of the work we did and instilled in these people that are now continuing to do that work.
Yeah, it's for me, it's creating generational change. You know, when you help change the trajectory of one person, just think about the whole, the generations that come after, directly after that one person, and how many people that ends up affecting. So when people say, hey, it's one person, one life at a time, that really does make an impact. So, you know, you always see like what happens and what can't be prevented, but the one thing that you can't show is what was prevented. What didn't happen because somebody was connected to a positive mentor, you know? So we just know in looking and seeing the beautiful families that are starting to rise up as, you know, in line of all of the young people that have been through our doors, and just proud to see that. And just gives you more hope for the future.
Of course, that has to be an amazing feeling. How has this work changed you all?
Well, it's been a dream come true for me. Often people often talk about dreams and can they become true facts. I'm living my dream every day. I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to instill in young people. So every day that I wake up and come to work, I'm living out my dreams. So it's special to me and to be a part of even feeling like we've been blessed as an organization to be in the position that we're in and to be able to feel like we could be a part of the solution of helping turn things around in Milwaukee, help get things right in our city, and to think that we could be instrumental in working with others to do that, that's special. So it definitely is a good feeling for me.
I think this journey has made me wise. It's made me more patient. It has emphasized and strengthened my faith, because there were times when I didn't know how we were going to do something or accomplish something, or money was tight and a new opportunity came that I just didn't think we'd be able to do. So to be able to have that perseverance, that faith, you know, that this is possible, and that if we're doing things for the right reasons and in the right way, that there's nothing that we can't accomplish. So it has definitely changed me as a person and brought me so much purpose and joy.
And you all talk about basketball is a central part of running Rebels. Why is that? Why did you choose that outlet to connect with people?
Well, as I stated, most of what we do here is driven by the young people. We have a joke back in the day that if the young people then in 1980 we used to go skating, if they had connected to skating, we'd have been the Rolling Rebels, we say. So basketball just so happened to be the strong passion of the majority of the young men that I worked with 40 years ago. So now, many years after that, we chose to do football because we had 15 young men that said they wanted to be involved in football. And that was that thing that would help draw them away from the negativity and bring them towards positivity. So we here look at our programs and the decisions about this agency are a lot youth driven in regards to what will work and help save lives and make our community a better place.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's kind of like it goes in phases depending on, if for us, it's all about what is it that the young people are interested in? And you might have a group this year, a very strong group of people who are into spoken word. So we do something around spoken word, and it might be 2 years later, that's not it anymore for the young people. So it's all about being tuned into what that thing is that creates passion in that young person or the people that you have around. And doing it. So for us, I think our strength is in our flexibility, in our creativity, in our willingness to keep, you know, that ebb and flow to meet the needs of who the young people are as individuals in that moment.
And I think when we work with the young people, we really want to see if we can assist them to be happy, but find out what's their lane, what's the career or the thing you really want to do. So when I pointed out the guy made it to the NBA, I mean, that was his choice. But music is something that we do a lot with here. The young people are very talented, from entertainers to graphic designers to videographers. So my hopes is and was from the beginning is to help somebody live their dream, become very successful, come back and help us, because a lot of times to be recognized, you need that person that, you know, is nationally recognized or darn near famous to everybody else, and come back and help bring attention to the good work that we do here at Running Rebels.
Victor and Don Barnett are the directors of Running Rebels. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about the 40th anniversary of the organization. Running Rebels will be hosting a virtual celebration on October 27th to commemorate the work they've done to improve the lives of Milwaukee youth. We'll take one last break and then return with the latest installment of our entrepreneurship podcast, How Did You Do That? That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers, and it's time now for our monthly segment on entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the executive director of Five Lakes Institute. And this is How Did You Do That?, a show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
They helped me really develop what became sort of my philosophy that, you know, you got to find something, a problem that's really worth solving that gets you excited about a solution.
Lori Cross dropped out of her all-girls high school in Michigan because there wasn't enough physics and math to keep her challenged. Technical college was a little better, but she found her place at Northwestern University. There, she got a degree in chemical engineering and became the first woman to play ice hockey on a men's NCAA team. After getting her master's degree in biomedical engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Lori was recruited to be a systems engineer at Baxter Edwards Laboratories, where she commercialized a series of catheter-based innovations from the research lab and completed her MBA along the way. That launched Lori's career as a product entrepreneur at a number of well-known med tech companies. From creating one of the first video arthroscopy devices to developing an integrated smart workstation for anesthesiologists, Lori again and again disrupted the status quo in markets ripe for a fresh approach. She's now an adjunct professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Executive MBA program, is founder and president of Mindspan Consulting, and is on the boards of several innovative companies. Lori, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thanks, Kathleen, for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Hey, let's start. You made a decision to drop out of high school. What did you do after you dropped out?
Well, looking back, I guess it does seem like a bold decision, but my parents had always emphasized learning over degrees or certificates. So when I was telling them that, you know, I was kind of running out of material to learn in high school, they suggested that I just begin taking classes at the local engineering school. So I dropped out. That's what I did. Strengthened some of my core skills, but really started looking at the disciplines that would, you know, get me excited and energized. And I found biomedical engineering and I was hooked. So I looked for programs and found there were only three universities that actually had the programs available. So I applied to all three.
So you landed at Northwestern University. How did you end up playing on Northwestern's men's hockey team?
Well, my parents are both Canadian, right? So our home was a hockey hotspot. That's all we did. But I was the first girl to play on a local boys team when I was like 12 years old. So after that, we had some energy and we created the first girls league, eventually ending up with a Can-Am tournament, and then traveled to Sweden and Finland for the world's first women's international hockey tournament. So you get the picture. I loved playing hockey. And so I went to Northwestern. They didn't have any. So my only option was to try out for the men's team. And well, I figured it was a good way to, you know, balance out my engineering geekiness and maybe make a few friends.
Well, and that goalie thing, it helped to have brothers who like to be the shooters, right?
Well, exactly. They got very good at deking me out, and I got pretty good at stopping them.
So after Northwestern, you got your master's degree at Rensselaer. Then you were hired at Baxter Edwards in California. From there, you went to Dionics. They recruited you to Boston to start their arthroscopy division. You drove entrepreneurial projects at both. Tell us about one of them.
Yeah, well, both of those early company experiences were so beneficial. They helped me really develop what became sort of my philosophy that, you know, you got to find something, a problem that's really worth solving that gets you excited about a solution, and then come up with a solution that's unique, that is integrating, like an alchemist, a whole bunch of different technologies from different disciplines, and then bring it to market with intelligence. Don't just dump it out there, but really think through how you're going to make that happen. So for example, Dionics, you bring up that one. It was where we drove arthroscopic surgery. Most orthopedic surgeons at the time were doing open procedures.
So an arthroscopic means less invasive, right?
Much less invasive, minimally invasive. So instead of cutting open the joint, we just go in with a little keyhole and a little straw device to look into the joint with one hole to actually do surgery in another. And at the time, there were a couple of surgeons that were looking through this really fuzzy optical straw, trying to assess whether this patient could benefit. And we thought, oh, there's got to be a better way. Can't we distend this joint, light it up, record what's happening, and make it easier to not only see what was in the joint, but also perform surgery. So a group of us got together, technologies from deep sea diving to fluid mechanics to CCD cameras that were used in astronomy, and miniaturized, integrated, thought it through, patented the technology, and we created the world's first video arthroscopy system with a lot of tech in it. And we were pretty excited.
You actually make it sound exciting.
Well, it was a lot of discovery, which is fun for engineers, but you know, putting it together in a practical way that we could actually manufacture, deliver, and maintain, not so easy. But just having the technology, many people thought, well, this is it. We'll just patent it, launch it, it'll go. But not so. The surgeons, turns out it's really much more difficult to do a triangulation technique versus an open technique. So we started to find the surgeons that would be good at it. We had a little test we devised that allowed us to see who would naturally be able to transfer those skills. We just did a lot of discovery of what kinds of patients, what kinds of payers, what kinds of settings would be most advantageous, which now, you know, most of this is done ambulatory. That was part of our idea, is to avoid the hospital setup. So in any case, we kind of built the ecosystem, built the launch so that the people who needed it most would uptake it quickly. And then it took off from there. In fact, it took off so quickly, we got bought by twice, first by Richards and then by Smith and Nephew. So I got further and further away from the things I loved, which is designing.
Well, but I get it. I mean, what you're saying is it's not just the research and the discovery, but it's applying it to the market, and in this case, building the market.
Right, exactly. And doing so in a disciplined way that wasn't just out there, but using staging and pacing to really pick the most responsive segment and nail it.
But you mentioned, you know, you kept getting to bigger companies because these acquisitions. So like so many entrepreneurs, you wanted to get to a smaller company. So you moved to a Finnish company called Datex that had 8 employees in the U.S. and sold around a dozen pieces of equipment here. Among other things, you figured out a unique solution for managing ventilator shortages during the SARS epidemic. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a flashback with all the recent situation with COVID. But yes, we were, Datex was quite a success story. Absolutely loved all the innovation there and the trust that was imparted to us by the owners. But at one point, we were building ventilators. And at the time, the SARS epidemic, there were numerous requests for purchases from all the countries across primarily Asia Pacific. And, you know, instead of buying 50 or 100 of these on an annual basis, they suddenly wanted thousands. And there was no way that we could produce, even with all of our competitors, could enough ventilators be produced. So we started to say, okay, how could we solve this problem? We said, could we ramp up production a little bit, 150%? Could we simplify design and get more life-saving equipment made? Yes, but not enough and not in the timeline they wanted. So we started to go back to the use case and said, what do these customers really want? What they really want is the use of ventilators in the event that a viral surge happens in their country, and they want them ready to go. And we realized if we fulfilled their request, they were going to have thousands of ventilators sitting in a warehouse, not well maintained and not really ready to go. So we put our heads together and said, well, what if we designed a different business model? And we tested whether it was possible for us to engage them in a contract where if they needed it, we would deliver just in time. And we negotiated that with many countries and created a central warehouse, multi-year contract, which allowed us to build relationships that paid off in so many ways, not only serving their viral response needs, but also creating additional business opportunities for the rest of our equipment post-pandemic. So it's still to this day, I think competitors scratch their heads thinking, I wonder what happened to all those ventilator orders. We just changed the rules of the game and actually met their needs.
That's an awesome story and very pertinent, as you said. You know, there's a perception that it's really difficult to be entrepreneurial in a big company. Why do you think you were able to do it time and time again?
Well, you know, big companies are difficult, but it's not impossible. You know, for me, it's about the risk profile. If you understand the risk profile of the owners, you can see that you've got to be focusing on prizes that are big enough, right? Enough to get their attention. But then think big, but act small. Get those small wins going. Invest like an entrepreneur would without asking for millions. Ask for 100,000, 50,000, and get something done. So small bites at the same apple allow them to come along and build a sort of continuity of commitment to the project. But I always held myself to a standard of testing the desirability, the usability, the feasibility of the product so that there was no surprises once we scaled up. I mean, the advantage of a big company is once you know that this is a winner, it scales up much more quickly. So better to gain their trust, because then when you say it's ready because you've tested it, they will enhance and get behind you for the bigger hits when you ask for them.
I love the way you make it sound so easy.
years of work. Not easy, but you know, think big, act small. That's sort of my motto.
Let's talk about how you came back to the Midwest. You were in Germany to work on an IT startup for Datex. You went from there to Madison, Wisconsin. How?
Yeah, I was trying to do an information management system in Europe based on success I had in the U.S. When I took it to Europe, I was slapped upside the head because basically the same drivers didn't exist in Europe. So I ended up sort of reframing that business and thinking about how I would do that. At the same time, our company was purchasing an anesthesia machine company here in Madison, Wisconsin. And I was on the due diligence team with them. And we dug in, we said, oh, this is more of a turnaround than a cash cow. So the CEO of the parent company turned to me and said, we think you should run it because this is a startup. I said, no, it's a turnaround. He said, well, just think of it as a startup with resources. So it was an interesting way to frame it up, because we really did have to start again, refreshing product line, channels, everything. And it was another great learning curve for me. And I love that experience. Great team.
So you turned it around successfully. And then a year after GE bought what was now called Datex Omeda, you moved to Viasys Healthcare, another turnaround, but this time in neuro and vascular systems. After years of commercializing technologies, this was the one job where you finally got more than a salary. You had a payday more like an entrepreneur. How did that happen?
Yeah, that was really nice. But I'll tell you, I will always be grateful to all the investors and mentors who allowed me to learn and fail on their dime. No, it was wonderful. And for me, the greatest payback was the ability to actually bring these solutions to market, the kinds of innovations that would disrupt the healthcare system forevermore. It was super rewarding once my dad had invasive cardiac surgery, and it was our equipment that kept him alive throughout that surgery. And I've had others who had a premature baby born that needed nitric oxide delivery to keep the lungs until they were ready to be mature. And it was so rewarding. So yes, it's great when you get the entrepreneurial payout, but I also feel like the rewards just ramped up throughout my career to be able to make a real difference. So grateful for both.
So I want to ask you what you're doing now, but before we do that, I think it's worth repeating, you know, kind of what your driving philosophy is. Let's just review that.
So no matter where I was, no matter what I did, it really came down to the three most important things being, you know, find a problem worth solving, one that really gets you excited, but has value for everybody involved. Then when it comes to engineering that solution, don't just go with what you have and what you know and what you're trying to leverage. Really open up with humility and explore other technologies from other industries, from other places, and don't be afraid to combine them, because that's how you get that sort of sustainable, unique value. And then, you know, when you bring it to market, don't just try everything. Test it. Pick the segments that work, use the channels that respond, and go small, but go hard and get it to work and extend from there. So problems we're solving, solutions that are creative, and then market launch that's very well disciplined.
So on this market launch, what would you do if you encountered obstacles? You know, you find that you can't put it there. How do you pivot that?
Yeah, you humbly pivot. I design and test. So you design early, test often. And when you are humble and listening to the market well, you know whether it's your execution that's failed, which means you should double down, or whether you've just got the wrong solution. I say pitch, pivot, or persevere. Pitch it out if it's bad, pivot if you just need to tweak a little bit, and persevere if you're right and it just needs more time. And the art of those selections, well, it helps if you have a team and good mentors to bounce things off of. So that's part of the secret too.
You're clearly a citizen of the world, but it's great to have you housed in our Midwest ecosystem.
Well, thank you so much. It's delightful. It's home for me, and I wouldn't choose any other place in the world.
Thanks for visiting with us today, Lori. Great talking to you.
It was a pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you very much.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting WUWM.com. You can also explore episodes of How Did You Do That at WUWM.com, at the iTunes Store, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.